Now we have David Grimm, the editor for our daily news site. He's here to talk about some recent online stories. I'm Sarah Crespi. First up, we have a story on what makes humans so nice to each other. Humans are much quicker than other primates to help out others in need, be it a person or a puppy. How did we get to be so, so altruistic? One theory is that we rely on each other for raising our children, and this trait underpins cooperation in general. So, Dave, what other animals raise their young cooperatively?
Well, actually, the animals that do that tend to be animals that are not closely related to us, which is kind of surprising. Animals like about 10% of birds are cooperative breeders. And when we say cooperative breeding, we mean that the mothers are getting help from relatives and sometimes even non-relatives raising their offspring. Meerkats and New World monkeys like tamarins and marmosets. What's really interesting is that much more closely related species to us, like chimpanzees, are not cooperative breeders. So somehow in our evolutionary history, our deep ancestors didn't have this cooperative breeding. And then somehow just the human line, at least among the great apes, regained this ability. And also humans tend to be a lot more altruistic. So there's been this idea that perhaps the two are linked.
To look into this, the researchers came up with a way to get primates to share, like sharing machinery. Even human children were able to use this. And how did it work?
Well, there's actually a video of it on the site that you can check out. But basically, they had a couple of animals side by side, and one could pull basically a board that would bring a treat. And for some primates, it was insects. For the human children, it was Smarties candy, something that they really wanted. What was key to the experiment is that one individual could pull the board so that the treat would get closer and closer, but that individual could never get the treat. It was only the other individual that could get the treat. So it was sort of a test of pure altruism. Are you going to help somebody next to you, who you might not even know, help get a treat, even if you can't get it yourself?
Right. And so after looking at trends and sharing among these various primates, who came out as the most generous?
Well, it turns out, as the researchers sort of suspected, that the species that were the cooperative breeders tended to be much more altruistic in this test.
Cooperative breeding is closely linked with altruism in this study. But now I have to ask, where did cooperative breeding come from?
Well, one idea is that as our species first moved from life in the trees to this much more precarious existence in the savanna and woodland environments, it became very, very difficult for women to raise children on their own. They really needed a lot of help. So we had to evolve this ability to help each other out. Otherwise, our species wouldn't have survived. And the legacy of that carries over to today, where we're still much more likely to help each other out than a lot of other animal species are.
Next up, we have a story on extraterrestrial clouds. The headline of this story is Water Clouds Detected 7 Light Years Away from Earth. But that actually leaves me with a lot of questions. Let's start with, how far away is 7 light years?
7 light years is a long way away, but not as long as it could be. For comparison, that's less than twice the distance to Alpha Centauri, which is the nearest solar system to us.
And you say the nearest solar system, does that mean that this place or this object where these clouds were identified was not part of a solar system?
It doesn't really qualify. This is a brown dwarf that these clouds were tentatively spotted on. And brown dwarfs are failed stars. They have so little mass that they can't sustain the nuclear reaction needed to power the suns that we think about. So after its birth, it fades and it cools. This is a very cold place. Its temperature is slightly below the freezing point of water. So it's a lot colder than Earth, although warmer than some places like Jupiter.
So it's a middling object hanging out all by itself. Why did anyone notice it, and what were they looking for?
Well, it's sort of an interesting object just because it's out there by itself, and some astronomers have been taking a close look at it. And what they discovered in this new study was when they took a bunch of infrared images of the object, which is known as WISE-J0855-0714. I'm sure you'll all remember that at home. They observed that the colors that they were getting back matched models of a brown dwarf with clouds of water ice. Now, clouds have been observed before outside of our solar system, but this is the first time that these have been water clouds. So that's really fascinating.
And the other part that the researchers point out is that it's partly cloudy, which I thought was a funny observation.
That's right. They say about half of this object is obscured by clouds. Now, this is a very cold, very dark and lonely place. So even if there are water clouds there, it's not the kind of place you'd want to vacation at anytime soon. But it is really interesting for astronomers to spot these sorts of things, because if we can spot water clouds on other planets that might be much more habitable to life, then there's a possibility that there may actually be life there.
Oh, cloudy with a chance of aliens.
That's right.
Lastly, we have a story on the transition from sea to land. At some point in the distant past, animals left the ocean and started cavorting on the land. A recent study suggests that this big transition may have started with a change in development rather than in genes. To look at this question, the researchers raised fish on land. Let's start with that, Dave. What kind of fish are we talking about here?
Well, Sarah, this is a type of fish called a bicher, and this is a really interesting fish. This is a fish that's very long. There's actually a picture of it on the site. It has lungs and big bony scales, and it uses its large pectoral fins that are behind its head to haul itself around land. So this is actually a fish that spends some time on land, usually when it's going to new watering holes. What's also really interesting about this fish is it's a very ancient fish. This is a lineage that sits at the base of an evolutionary tree where you had a split between ray fish, which are most kinds of fish, and a group that includes lobe-fin fish, such as lungfish and coelacanths, and even the land animals. So this is a very ancient fish, and that's actually one of the reasons the researchers chose to study it.
The study design is kind of deceptively simple here. Go to the pet store, buy 150 bichers, raise some on land and some in the water. After they did this, what kind of differences were observed between land-raised and sea-raised fish?
What was really fascinating is even though the sea-raised fish can walk on land, those that were raised on land were much better at it. Not only were they better, but they're actually their skeletons reshaped to help them walk on land a lot better. For example, the bones that support their fins and attach from the back of the head took on new shapes. The equivalent of their collarbone grew longer so it could better support their body. They got much better range of head motion when they're raised on land, which you don't really need in the sea because you can just sort of swim to what you're looking at. But on land, you really need to be able to swivel your head. So the researchers saw all these really fascinating skeletal changes that allowed these guys to not only live on land, but really take very well to this terrestrial environment.
These physical changes in the animals were due to influences on their development. We're not talking about changes to the genetic code or anything like that. How does this model of adaptation work in the long run if these changes are not something they can pass down?
But one possibility is that, or one theory is that these animals that are much more plastic, as the researchers say, this is much more malleable, at least in terms of their skeletons, are the ones that get selected for. And then over time, it's these animals, these changes these animals experience actually become translated to the genes. They become much more hardwired changes. And then you see this evolution over time where these animals don't just have to adapt to land every generation. They're actually born with a much better ability to survive on land than their ancestors were.
It seems like this would be difficult to prove one way or the other. In the fossil record, these changes to their physical structure would appear just like any other changes that we had attributed to genetic and evolutionary change over time. Can we tell anything about that at this point?
And that's a great question. And the answer is we don't really know. We know, according to the fossil record, that these types of changes took place. What we don't know is how.
Okay, so what else is on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Sarah, we've got a story about a new way to wipe away bad memories. Also a story about whether one of the world's leading independent ways to accredit animal research labs is really as effective as people think. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about the latest development in the stem cell controversy that's rocking Japanese science. And we're also keeping track of the Iceland volcano, when it's going to blow, if it's going to blow, and why.
And how to say its name.
And why it's going to blow, and how to say its name. Exactly. So maybe not so much on that last part, but be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the editor for our online daily news site. I'm Sarah Crespi. This segment is part of the Science Podcast. You can hear the whole show on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and the Science website, www.sciencemag.org.